Hello there, boys and girls. We have a very special little show for you tonight.
Hey, hey, it's YouthCast.
Let's try it out. Okay, you go first.
My name is Molly Adams, and on this episode, I bring a tale of hustling, scrapping, and scraping, all in the name of a good read. In Boston's Chinatown neighborhood, residents had gone without a library for over 50 years. Some enterprising folks who go by the name of Boston Street Lab decided to do something about that when they saw how many storefronts were vacating as the economy slowed down. They got a commercial space donated for 12 weeks and set about making something useful. Independent producer and young person Mark Saldana has their story in Storefront Library. Don't Hit Stop as the outro music fades. Mark and I talked on the phone about this piece, and he had this gem to say.
I think radio is not just forgiving, but it gives you a chance to kind of explore in the sense that you don't just have to file it down immediately to the smallest possible, cleanest story to try to get in some newspaper somewhere.
So this is Storefront Library by Mark Saldana.
It's a scene you might expect from any number of libraries. Patrons are coming up to the front desk to return books. Children are running around playing, and a group of elderly people are crowded around a table, chatting and reading the news.
I have to say, in this community, like the physical newspaper, there's nothing to replace that. We've been buying two copies of each of the major Chinese newspapers every day, and we just started ramping down and buying one copy. They noticed right away.
The sounds you're hearing are from the Chinatown Storefront Library, where, for 3 months, an experiment in micro-urban design transformed 3,000 square feet of idle space in Boston's densest neighborhood into a thriving community center. And then it was gone. This is the story of a community without a library, a few people with a plan, and the benefits of being nimble and thinking small.
Just day-to-day seeing people being excited when they found a book, or you know how happy people were just to have a place to sit and do their own thing.
Amy Chung was the program director at the Storefront Library, and from November 2009 to January 2010, she spent her days interacting with customers.
And so in some ways it's actually really fun to see people that comfortable in this space, to really use it in the way that they wanted to.
It's known to many as a commercial district. But Boston's Chinatown neighborhood is home to a small community of around 8,000 people. Families have lived here for generations, and a good deal of them remember the old Chinatown Library branch, which was closed in 1956 to make room for a highway. For a community that today is in need of social services, libraries aren't just a question of nostalgia, as a survey done in 2001 revealed.
Right, so the Friends of the Chinatown Library actually started when youth from a group called the Chinese Youth Initiative actually went out and surveyed people and asked people in Chinatown, what's missing in this neighborhood? What do you really need? And they heard from a lot of people that it was a library.
This new community advocacy group, the Friends of the Chinatown Library, published a report in June 2008 on the feasibility of a new branch that was actually commissioned by the city. In over half a century without a library, nobody had come closer to getting one back. The Friends waited. But shortly after publication, the American economy entered into the recession that has left city budgets meager, and their project, like many others of its type, was set aside.
There's been a campaign to start a library in Chinatown for years now, but I think specifically the fact that Boston Street Lab decided to just start our library and test it out and operate it as an experiment, that was really exciting.
Amy was working with youth in the Chinatown community when she heard of a group offering a radically different approach to the local branch issue.
We wanted to take a vacant storefront in the neighborhood in the middle of a fairly severe recession when there really isn't much hope of renting it, at least over these couple months, and model a public library.
Sam Duvall is co-founder of Boston Street Lab, along with his wife, Leslie. Its mission is to find ways to pilot cultural and civic programs in dense urban environments. The Duvalls also happen to be residents of Chinatown and were paying attention when the Friends of the Chinatown Library's plans failed to win public money. So they came up with their own plan.
Our goal was not to implement something on that scale, but was to do something small that would demonstrate some of the programs and services that would be in a library like that and offer those in the neighborhood, but also take a look at how people were using a space like this.
1 year later, after all kinds of planning and collaboration, after recruiting dozens of volunteers and hiring one program manager, the Boston Street Lab set its experiment into motion. Chinatown had a storefront library.
If you didn't like something, you could come right up and tell me, and you did. People did.
So what do patrons expect from an impromptu library in an abandoned storefront? Well, Boston Street Lab hadn't put money into barcode readers. They hadn't planned on circulating books at all.
Originally, when they conceived of the idea, this was going to be a reading room and not a lending library, because we actually got a lot of advice from professional librarians that said, you know, trust us, if you're going to do circulation, just it can be messy and complicated.
But within a week, they realized that the capacity to check out books in this community was non-negotiable.
I thought, we just have to do this. Like, people are asking for it. It's almost what's expected of a library, I guess.
So volunteers started using an Excel spreadsheet to check books out and bluffed about late fees. There were none. There were countless little adaptations like this. The lights were too dim over the conference reading table, or the patrons wanted more paperbacks in Chinese, but more children's books in every language.
During our first week, or first 2 weeks, actually, if you look on the blog, you can see we were working basically around the clock making these kinds of adjustments. We changed our hours dramatically to be open on the weekend and also open on Mondays to help restaurant workers who have Mondays off come in with their families. We modified some of our programs to fall during different hours. I think the point here was that we were running hard because we were temporary, but we were also always going into this in sort of an experimental mode, and I think that was helpful. We were looking for what worked.
One of the most striking things about the storefront space is that every corner seems to solve a problem. Students from the Harvard Graduate School of Design created ultralight shelves and computer desks that formed friendly reading nooks in a square area that may once have been an office cubicle. Kids were invited to read and draw, listen and draw, and otherwise be artistic and silly. Amy explained to me how a space like this, where kids and their parents can be doing separate things, but in a sense still be doing them together, simply has not existed in Chinatown.
You know, where can you go where you don't have to buy something? Because, you know, at that restaurant, that bakery, you know, you have to still purchase something to be able to sit there. Plus, we're in a dense urban environment, so people who are living here are in apartments that are not necessarily very big, or they may be shared with other families or other people. I think having a space like the Chinatown Storefront Library meant that this was a place where people could go to almost as like an extension of their living room.
I come here very often, 2 times a week maybe.
I spoke with Robert Chan about his experience with the Storefront Library. He lives in Chinatown.
Do you like it here?
Yeah, it's very good, yeah.
How do you see people around you sort of using it? Do you feel like people get use out of it?
I think this is what we call a multi-purpose for our own community, and I can see a lot of my friends, they come here and taking newspapers, or they just, a lot of time they're getting together beside their readings.
People would come here and just kind of hang out.
Both Sam and Amy emphasize the importance of walk-up patrons, people who stop into the library out of curiosity in the middle of their days and feel welcomed. Community members who find something familiar and connect with it. Keep in mind that the majority of the population is either elderly or very young. And for them, the mile walk to the closest library branch at Copley Square is no small task, especially during the long New England winters. Amy explains that for that process of walking up and feeling welcomed to truly happen, the space needs to be here.
The thing about the Copley Branch Library is that although it has sort of enormous resources, it's really intimidating to walk in. It's literally really big, and you can feel lost in it. Whereas here at the Storefront Library, literally being on the street where there's a window you can look in, and then, you know, you walk in and immediately there's someone to greet you with a smile, and that person potentially can also speak the language that you're most comfortable with. I think that's really huge. So what is a library exactly? Is it a community space? Is it just lending out books? Is it programs? And it really is a little bit of everything.
When I first visited the storefront library in the middle of January, I found a place more intimate and cozy than the phrase vacant storefront had led me to imagine. Here was something that, as I glanced around and met with people, seemed to be working. But unlike a publicly funded building, the storefront library was part of an experiment, and the library phase was coming to an end. It was sad to think that in just 2 weeks, the room in which I was standing would once again be an empty storefront, and all the patrons would be somewhere else. It was sad to Amy as well.
And seeing people really use the space and loving the space, it's hard to sort of explain, you know, the experimental nature of it, because I know people just want a library, and we're here to fill that need. So I think that's why it is bittersweet.
I think there is sort of a little bit of bittersweetness to this, but there is a sweetness to it. I think the point of this project always was to create a model of what could be. We're fortunate that a lot of the materials for the project and also some of the ideas from the project are going to be taken up by other people in the community.
During the final week, volunteers transcribed handwritten feedback from patrons and posted it online. One of these comments reads, "We strongly urge the government to open a permanent library in Chinatown to promote multicultural society and to benefit future generations." RR writes this in English and in Chinese. Others are more direct. Great community space. Definitely need a permanent library.
So this is obviously closing in a couple of days. Do you think it'd be good if like a library followed this?
That is everybody looking for, hopefully get our own community library, but there is always talk, you said no action, and also I got no idea.
The struggle for a library doesn't end with the storefront experiment, and patrons understand this. In Boston Street Lab, well, they couldn't keep their experiment running forever.
I think if we operate the storefront library for like 2 more months, 3 more months, it would probably outgrow itself, because we wouldn't have enough space for more books, and because, you know, eventually we would get more people into the space and we'd run out of seating, things like that. So I think we were 3,000 square feet. I think 3,000 square feet in the end is probably a little bit small, but, you know, full branch library is usually about 20,000 square feet. I don't think it necessarily needs to be that big.
So how many square feet should the ideal library be? And what day of the week gets the most people to story time? All these considerations are part of the huge amount of data, some anecdotal, some quantitative, headcounts and interviews, that Boston Street Lab has collected over the course of the project. They hope this information will be helpful for the Friends of the Chinatown Library in finally getting a branch in their neighborhood. In the meantime, books from the collection are finding new homes in daycares and high school libraries. But in addition to the collections of books and data, the storefront library has helped build a sense of possibility and of urgency in Boston's Chinatown. And at the heart of this effort wasn't something huge, but rather a few people that adopted the spirit of being nimble, paying close attention, and going at big problems in small ways.
How can you still make big impact, but, you know, do things in a smaller space or doing things in a quote-unquote lighter way? You know, it's totally possible, I think.
I visited the library after it had closed down, and the shelves had been taken down and books distributed into boxes. I noticed that, for the first time, the space looked like an abandoned storefront. I could have been staring in at any number of businesses in one of countless neighborhoods across America. But for the residents of Chinatown, something had happened. People had come out, read, laughed, loafed around, all in the most unlikely of places. And while these images may not add up to a library, neither does the fading memory of branches past. And so what do our communities need? What works? Well, how small can we think? How closely can we listen?
That was Storefront Library. This is me talking to Mark Saldana, the producer. So, Mark, hi. Nice to meet you over the phone.
Yeah, nice to meet you. How are you doing?
Good. For my own knowledge, because you can never figure this out from the internet, like, who you are, where you're from, how you got into radio.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm from Boston area. I'm from Lexington. I go to school in St. Paul, Minnesota, in McAllister. So I kind of bounce between the East Coast and the Midwest. And when I was in high school, I really loved zines. I was, like, super into zines and went to the zine library in Harvard Square. And that was sort of like my quirky medium of choice. And what I loved about it was it was kind of like this, you know, this artifact. It was really, really playful. I really liked the medium. And but I didn't really think that like the ideas that I loved most in zines really could kind of cross over to other mediums. And it wasn't really until I kind of lucked out. I got this this fellowship with the Northwest Institute for Social Change, which is run in Portland, Oregon, and they do like social activism in social media. And so it was like radio and video and writing. And I was mostly thinking, oh, I'll come into it and I'll really, you know, fall in love with video or something. But the radio portion was just fantastic. It was really cool. It's just kind of so honest and so kind of so wide, you know. Like anytime you record sound, there's just so much there, and you're kind of just trying to walk the listener through some story, some portion of it. But anyways, I found it to be like really, really beautiful and really powerful. So
and like zines, a little esoteric, maybe.
Yeah, you know, zines have that sort of. A sort of sense of craft, and you really think about the person who's making it, and you think about the process, and I think radio really, for me, was so similar because you really can't leave out the process of making audio when you're making audio. You can't leave out like the little problems with tape. The best radio I've heard really just plays with the medium, and it plays with what works and what doesn't, and plays with the fact that, you know, you're speaking to an audience. And also this whole, sort of you've covered with your podcast, the whole youth movement, there really is a sense that you can kind of just make something of yourself and just kind of put out something small, and maybe it can become bigger, or you can have a kind of a place within this big spectrum of possible sort of, you know, like radio expressions. And
do you think that radio more, I mean, I think like the radios and the zines, but like in other media that you've worked with, radio in particular is more open and welcoming to young people? Because it sort of sounds like you feel that way.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think, I've loved writing my whole life, and I've oftentimes considered myself a writer. But one thing that I don't love so much about a lot of the writing that I've done or seen or read is that it kind of hides a lot of the process. I think radio is not just forgiving, but it gives you a chance to kind of explore in the sense that you don't just have to file it down immediately to the smallest possible, cleanest story to try to get in some newspaper somewhere. You can really get to some really, really big truths. I think for young people, I think especially that process seems great. It seems like there's a lot of, it kind of eases you in and gives you a lot of places to kind of improvise, I guess.
So when making the Storefront Library piece, what was your strategy in capturing that space in sound?
My big regret is that I didn't find out about it earlier. You know, I didn't actually get to the space to interview people until it was only 3 days from closing. I interviewed a couple people after the fact, and then I interviewed a few people on that day. And when I was there that day, I really wanted to focus on sound, like things that I could possibly collect and record that might be gone if I don't do that in that moment.
That's nicely poetic that even though the same general sounds would be happening every day would still have a different set of people in the library and it would sound a little different. That's nice.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially that day was really interesting too because there was a library conference in town, so the National Library Association. So there are people coming in giving tours, but then there were also people that were saying goodbye, and then there were also just kids hanging out, and you know, it was a typical day, but it was kind of like a super typical day because there are such diverse things happening, you know. So I really wanted to if not explicitly focus on it because I only had so much time, you know, I wanted to at least get hints of it, at least have, you know, maybe in the background, you know, some Chinese being spoken and things like that.
I also liked the scoring that you did with this piece. I think the music comes in at really nice moments and goes out. There's precision in your scoring. How important is that to you in making a piece, picking music and deciding where it goes?
Yeah, well, So the idea I was saying earlier about radio being this sort of really wide, open, kind of improvisational place where you can kind of walk people through sounds, I really like that tension between having some of the sound inequalities, you know, some pops and buzzes and overheard noises, but then also having this music kind of lock things in place and kind of whisk the story towards a point of precision and clarity, you know, even if just for a little bit.
So my last question would be, why? Did you just make this for fun, or was this for a class? Or, you know, because sometimes when I see people getting into this, you know, kind of, when you're doing it as a student, as an independent young person, it seems especially esoteric when you're not connected with anything and you don't have a guaranteed broadcast. But did you have one for this, or was this just sort of for your own personal artistic exploration?
And as I started doing this project, I realized that I really like, within sort of community activism, you know, I think the role of storytelling is really interesting. And I think for me, that's something, that's a place I really want to be in. I really want to sort of listen closely to what people are doing, you know, what's working, and sort of capture and really respect, you know, some of the efforts that are really going right, you know, in our communities. And so though it wasn't really tied to any specific obligation, any sort of class, it really helped me figure out, you know, what I want to be, how I want to be encouraging some of these sorts of organizing, and also it felt really good to finally connect to Boston. You know, since I'm living in Lexington, Massachusetts, it's a few towns away. It's not the city at all, and to really learn more about this neighborhood. You know, Chinatown at a time when I'm kind of flitting between the Midwest and the East Coast and now Japan, it really helped me feel grounded. So personally, that was really good. So it was kind of all those things, I guess.
Well, thank you for talking with me, Mark.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking to me and paying my piece of attention. I really appreciate that.
YouthCast is a project of Generation PRX. Generation PRX is a website devoted to supporting, connecting, and distributing youth-produced radio. Check it out at generationprx.org. And since you're on the internet, also check out youthcast.org. We got links, we got videos, we got audio that's not part of the podcast. So many goodies. And if you become our fan on Facebook at facebook.com/youthcast, you can have those goodies delivered right to your internet doorstep. YouthCast, where radio makes you wish you were young again.